Hey guys, the following podcast is a Lady Gang Network and Podcast One production, which means it's going to be awesome. Welcome back to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and today Allison Punch is back to help us break down The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington for The Stacks Book Club. The book is an in-depth look at the neglect, scandal, and lack of oversight in the death investigation industry. There are no spoilers this week. If you're not sure about this book, check out The Short Stacks episode 17 with Radley Balco, where he gives a peek into this book and how it came to be. For more on everything we discuss on today's episode and links to The Stacks social media and Allison's social media accounts, click the link in the show notes. Also, if you shop through the link in the show notes, you're helping to keep The Stacks free. Every other week, I host a virtual book club with other listeners at The Stacks, where we discuss the most recent book from the show. If you're interested in joining us, head over to patreon.com/thestacks. You can be a part of this community and help make sure we continue to make episodes that you love. Want a tip for reading more nonfiction? Try audiobooks. It's a great way to get into the genre. The reader of the book can add layers of excitement to the story and help make sense of sometimes dense language. The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist is fantastic on audiobook. And if you're new to the audiobook landscape, check out Audible. Listeners of this show get a free audiobook download and a free 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/thestacks. Keep spreading the word about The Stacks, whether it's by telling a friend, writing a review, or sharing that you love the show on social media. I see all of you and I appreciate you so much, so keep it up. All right, now it's time for my conversation with Allison Punch about The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington. All right, everybody, we are back again this week with the lovely Allison Punch. Allison, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yay. We're talking today for the Stacks Book Club about The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, a true story of injustice in the American South. It's written by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington. I don't think we're going to spoil this book because it's nonfiction and there's not a lot to spoil, though there is like some information that you maybe wouldn't know or like kind of like the fallout. But I feel mostly from the beginning, the book kind of tells you what it is. Mm-hmm. If you're worried about spoilers, we did interview Radley Balco a few weeks ago. And you can find that on the Short Stacks. I believe it's Short Stacks number 17. So if you're interested in a totally spoiler-free conversation about this book, check it out. If you're on the fence or you think you won't read the book, I think you're safe to listen either way. So we're going to start where we always start. Allison, what did you think of this book?
Okay, so I liked it a lot. I think I wasn't sure how I'd feel about it. I think that the pace of it was interesting because like when it went back into the so it starts out by sort of laying the scene of the crimes that I thought it was only going to focus on those two crimes, but it talks about so much more. It talks about the history of coroners. It talks about like all different types of history. So it was like very up and down. Honestly, at times this book was really confusing to me because it was just so hard to wrap my head around how corrupt
right.
and messed up all of this like is. Like, I didn't know that there was a difference between coroners and medical professionals. And also, it was confusing to me because it was so not aligned with CSI. And I was like, I knew that was fiction, but I didn't know how fiction
right.
it was.
Right.
And it was just like, my world shifted.
Sure.
What did you think?
I liked the book. I, for whatever reason in my life, the week that I was reading this book, really struggled to like get into it.
Same.
It never quite fully clicked with me. I think also because Mr. Stacks read it before me and was like, oh my God, it's amazing. I could read it in like 2 days.
Yeah, you told me
so
that.
I think that I thought that it was going to be like really catchy from jump. And it wasn't catchy for me, like in the same way that like Just Mercy is like
right.
unputdownable.
Exactly.
It's
yeah.
not quite that.
No, definitely not.
But the information in it is wild, like mind-blowing. I think in the introduction, they're like, you're going to laugh, you're going to cry, you're going to be like, what mm-hmm. the fuck? And I definitely like felt a lot of those kind of feelings. I mean, I didn't cry because I don't really cry when I read. It takes a lot. But I definitely was like, this is sad and like this is great and this is horrible and I can't believe it. I also felt like I had issues with the author's points of view sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know which author is which. I don't know who is who. Like they write it kind of in one voice, but there were some points of view where I was like, I don't think that you're going deep enough.
I think, totally agree.
Yeah. Especially when it came to like race and class.
I think that there was a little bit of like, we don't want to go there, or like, we don't know how to go there, or we actually don't even see this stuff.
Totally.
So I don't hold it against them. Like, I don't think it was malicious, but I think that it was like a large gaping hole where, you know, because race is such a huge part, totally. And like anti-blackness is such a huge part of the criminal justice system in America. And this book takes place specifically in Mississippi and a little in Louisiana. And like those places are notorious for being terrible, terrible, terrible. And they kind of go into like the history of like Jim Crow and like the lynching. And then they kind of like leave that history in a way that I felt like, are we going to bring that back? Are we going to talk about how this is the same?
It doesn't pass the like anti-racist smell test. First of all, I started reading this book and I was like, okay, this is a book by white men. So like, and you were like, it's about racism. And I was like, I don't know. But the first thing in the introduction, he's like, well, Hain is not racist. He was married to a black woman.
I literally took that.
And I was just like, it's like the prickles up on my back are like, whoosh, you know, it's like, that does not, no.
Right. That Did just, you listen to the conversation that yes. I had with Radley Balco?
So I was
– Go ahead. Can
I, okay. I was about to say that. So listening to that conversation on the short sex made sense to me because I was like, this is legal stuff. Mm-hmm. This is them trying to not get sued by Hain. Right. But at the same time, like, it's still cowardly. Right. Like, it's still – you know, I think you just I don't
leave
know.
It out.
Yeah. Like, it was just so – like, his intent. And it's like, racism is not about intent. Like, it's about power and policies and, you know, like – So we were just talking before about how Kendi blurbed it, and I was shocked because this book does not seem to play with his, like, you know, racist policies are put in – like, racist ideas are put in place to support racist policies. And this – it just, like, it didn't – you know, I think that the black wife thing really, really pissed me off because you just can't say that someone's not racist because they have a black wife. That's not how that works.
Right. No, I agree. I mean, that's something I took that note. It's in the introduction. It happens again later in the book.
Yeah.
And I think that like when I took the note, I was like, what the fuck? But then after I spoke to Radley Balco and he talked a lot about how like they spent months and months with legal.
Yeah.
It feels like I think the correct choice would have just been to remove that from the book.
Yeah.
And to not comment one way or the other if they thought he was or wasn't racist.
Yeah.
Because if you're only citing the evidence that you think that he's not racist because he has a white wife or black wife for a short period of time versus like the history of his work, I think if you feel like you can't draw a strong conclusion that's backed up by facts, I think you just have to remove that. So I think it's damaging to say he's not necessarily racist because he was married to a black woman. It's kind of like, well, okay, maybe he's not necessarily racist, but also maybe you just have to pull this out. Like maybe you just have to say, this is inconclusive and we don't want to go anywhere near that. And I feel like I would have respected that choice more.
Well, I think you're so right. They spend all this time talking about like history of like how coroners and medical I'm saying that weirdly.
Coroners.
Saying how coroners are – there's all this history about how coroners are used to uphold white supremacy. Like in the, you know, lynching and all of that things that I thought were really well written. But it's so true what you said. Like – and then he goes into this like 90s stuff, Hain and West, and it's like – race is just not there.
It's like disconnected from the history.
Right.
And if you aren't familiar, the history basically, because there is a difference between a coroner and a medical examiner. I'm going to do a shitty job explaining it. They do a very good job in the book. And also, if you want a shorter but better job, you should check out John Oliver. He does a piece on it, which we also talked about with Radley Balco. But it's very quick and explained. So basically, a medical examiner is a doctor, MD, someone who's gone to medical school. And they're pathologists. Their job is to look at bodies and figure out why they died. A coroner comes from like the Middle Ages. It was a political position. It was a knighted position in Britain. It then, when it came to America, it kind of was like they only investigated deaths that were suspicious, but it was either elected or appointed. So it had a lot of politics around it. And in the Jim Crow South, it became a way to exonerate people for crimes that were committed against black people. So there would be a lynching and the coroner would come and say, I investigated and we can't figure out who did it. Or this wasn't a murder. This wasn't really a lynching. This person had a heart attack and then shot themselves. Or like they would make up these crazy answers to let the white folks off. So it kind of has this like very political and racist history, in addition to being connected to money. It was not a paid position, but you could make money and you could also take money from victims, like off their person. And so it was kind of this like crazy corrupt industry. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the history that we're given before we get in specifically to Stephen Hain and
Michael West.
And Michael West. I'm like, what's his name? Stephen Hain and Michael West, who are the cadaver king, Stephen Hain, who's the coroner, and then the country dentist is Michael West, who is a dentist by day, but he also is a jack of all trades of forensic bullshit. And those people seem to be very removed from the history that we have gotten in the first few pages of the book.
Yeah, and I think that it's just, yeah, it wasn't really connected. It like he's like this lays the scene for them, but then there's no race and class analysis of the bullshit that they
like the actual things that they perpetrated. And I do think that some of that was like legal stuff, which is a bummer. But I also feel like you got to figure out a way to draw that line,
right?
Because like I think some readers will see it, and I think some readers will not necessarily see it. And like when you put it in the 90s and the 2000s, there's this way that you can kind of go around it and say, oh, racism doesn't exist anymore or whatever. Or it's not the same as it was, or they weren't lynching. These were murders committed by people, you know. I also think like they don't really talk about the race of the victims or the guy who actually committed the murders, Johnson.
Yeah.
So we know that Levon Brooks and
Kennedy
Brewer. I'm really doing good with names today. We know that Levon Brooks and Kennedy Brewer are both black men, and that's stated expressly in the book. And those are kind of like there are two case studies that the book kind of is anchored in, and it goes on much more about the cadaver king and the country dentist. But we know that those two are black men, but like it's not expressly stated that either of the children or the family. I think the assumption is that they are, but it's not expressly stated, which I thought was an interesting choice.
Yeah. I would say like with this book, I did really like it. I do feel like I learned a lot and I have new language, which is what I'm always looking for when I read nonfiction, is like new language to talk about something. But it was more about like the specific, right? Coroner, medical examiner, forensic, junk science sort of a thing. I feel like if you're looking to learn about the criminal justice system, this is not the only book you should be reading.
No.
Like you need to be reading Just Mercy or The New Jim Crow or both, and then maybe read this book. But
yeah,
I don't know. So I think, yeah.
And this book is different than those other books because it's not so much about the incarceration of either of the two men.
Right.
It really is like a deep dive into this forensic science and like how it's bullshit and how it's so deeply entrenched in this case, Mississippi. But it felt like Mississippi was indicative of
everywhere.
Every state.
I mean, it happened in Texas. It happened in like – I just was reading this book and I was like, how do any crimes ever get solved?
Right.
I don't know. I don't believe that they do anymore.
Right. So they say in the book that 2-10% of all convictions are actually wrongful convictions, which means in a prison population of 2.3 million, you can see anywhere between 46,000 and 230,000 innocent people locked away, which is – that's a lot of people. Like five people feels like a lot if that person's your cousin or that person's you.
Right.
But 230,000 people who are wrongfully convicted, that's terrifying.
And especially if you look – I mean if you add race and class analysis, right?
Right?
Like the people who don't have resources to properly defend themselves, so that's a class analysis. Or the people who are viewed by society as criminals because of anti-blackness in America, that's race analysis, and that's just like that's not really addressed.
So one of the things that is in – so the introduction or the foreword is written by John Grisham, which I thought was like kind of
so
weird and cool and interesting. And I know that he does a lot of work with the Mississippi Innocence Project. And like I think he's like kind of like the patron saint of them. And he writes this introduction. And one of the things he talks about are the eight different reasons for wrongful conviction and how in this book the two guys are both victims of all eight, which usually he's like, it could be a storm of a few or all of them. But here's what he says they are. One is, and he says in no particular order. So bad police work, prosecutorial misconduct, false confessions, faulty eyewitnesses, jailhouse snitches, bad lawyering, sleeping judges, and junk science. And I feel like definitely in this book, these people, both men, are definitely the victim of all of these, like, pretty clearly and in your face. I think maybe one is not the victim of Jailhouse Snitch. One is and one isn't.
Yeah.
But otherwise, it's, like, pretty egregious and aggressive. And I just wonder, like, what other industries and parts of life in American society are also this fucked up? Like, this was kind of like, holy shit, I had no idea. But that's got to mean the other...
Well, it just sucks because, like, everything about the criminal justice system is so messed up, right? Like, policing, there's so much racial bias, misconduct, blah, blah, blah. And then you get to the judges, and then you get to this, and then you get to that. And it's just, like, at every level,
right,
it's corrupt and racist.
Right. Right. And it's, like, unless someone confesses not falsely to a crime, and there's evidence to back up their confession, and they're not coerced to confess because they want, like, a lesser sentence.
Right.
Like, there's just really no way. I mean, there are ways to know, but it, like, gets really hard. And then the amount of arrests and prosecution that people are doing, like, the amount of crimes you can go to jail for, it's crazy. Mm-hmm. You don't have to go to jail for everything.
Like, and then, yeah, I just think, like, this also is just, like, society views people as disposable who have committed crimes. Right. And it's, like, who even determines what is a crime? And, like, who even determines what is criminal?
Right. Well, so one of the things they say in this book that I think is worth spending a little time on is they say that they're okay with locking up people with junk science or for committing small crimes because likely they committed other crimes. Or, like, likely they could have done something else that they just didn't get caught for.
Which is so racialized. Right. Like, or and class. You know, it's like, what does that even mean? Like,
right.
Everyone has committed a crime, right?
Sure.
Like, these two, like, Stephen Hayne and Michael West are committing crime because they're committing perjury.
Right. Right. But, like, that this idea, like, that it's okay. Like, after I finished reading the book and I was talking to Mr. Sachs about it, he was saying, like, how can these people sleep at night? I'm like, it's actually shockingly easy for them because they feel like they're doing the work of getting bad people off the street.
Yeah.
You know, getting these bad hombres off the street, right?
Oh my gosh. And it's like, because that's the thing about West, is he is never able to come up with a suspect on his own. He's only able to match, like, once the police or the deck detectives have a suspect, he's able to, like, match the top of their teeth to this bite mark, quote unquote, that is really just an animal or something that bit this kid.
Right.
And, okay, I'm sorry. Like, not to be crass about the kid dying, but it's like, that it's total bullshit, and it's so baffling that it's able to be allowed, but everyone believes him because he's the view of authority, which is, like, this, you know, white man with these degrees and and all this money. And
have you ever done jury duty?
No.
Me neither. Damn, I wish you had. I wanted to talk about it. I've never
I believe in jury nullification, so I hope that I am a jury person.
What do you mean you believe in jury nullification?
Well, I don't know, maybe it's too much, but so, like, jury nullification is this concept that I learned about from Professor Paul Butler, who talks about how, like, if you don't agree in a law, like, you don't believe in the drug war, you should be on the jury and then vote that they're not guilty, even if the evidence is that they're guilty, because you don't believe in the law.
I see.
So, like, if you're, you know, someone for, like, mostly drug crimes, right? Like, you can say they're not guilty because you don't believe in.
Interesting. I never heard of that.
Mm-hmm. It's from Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice.
I like it. I believe in jury nullification. But, like, one of the things that comes up in this book about this science, which is quote-unquote science, because the field of forensics actually isn't based in science. It's based in law enforcement.
Which is fascinating.
I thought it was fascinating. I didn't know that either. I just assumed it was science because it's called science.
Right.
But the way in which science is allowed, like, that was one of the things that was fascinating. The way in which science is or is not allowed in the courtroom for juries, it made me really freaked out about being, like, if you had to be on a jury of, like, a big
case. Yeah.
Because they're asking you to know too much, / they're expecting you not to know anything so that they can just, like, dupe you.
Well, and the thing they talk about this in the book, which again, it was very confusing for me because it was just so far from reality. The way, like, science is accepted in the courtroom once it has been, like, widely, quote unquote, like, widely accepted in the field. And it's like, what does that mean?
Right.
And that's not clear. It's just totally up to, they're basically relying on the judge to be an arbiter of, like, what is good science or not, which the judges don't know. And so if they think, oh, well, other judges have ruled on this, then it must be good science. So they allow it to be in their courtroom when it isn't.
Right. But then that puts all the onus on the jury.
Yeah. Oh, and the jury. And the worst part about it is, can we talk about the, I forget what it's called, but when these people were trying to then, this maybe is a spoiler, like, because it happens at the end of the book, when these people are then trying to overturn their conviction.
Oh, yeah.
And they say you must, in order to overturn or to challenge a conviction as wrongful, you must challenge it within 1 year of when you knew that, like, the evidence was faulty.
Right.
So this is like 2010, 2013 or something. Yeah. And these people are trying to challenge their convictions because Hain and West by this point have been widely discredited. Again, not really a spoiler. Like, we knew this was coming. Right. That's why they're so, like, defensive of him, whatever. But then at this point, the judges say, oh, well, you know, people talked about how Hain was a quack in 2006. So we're not – it's been too late. You had only until 2007. But people were still being prosecuted with his evidence from, like, 2006 to 2010.
And people are still being – like, he was still a witness at that time for the state and the defense. Yeah. Like, he was still defending old convictions and becoming a prime witness for the defense. Yeah. It's really – that's really, like, the jig, as they say. You know, the
jig
is up.
There's just no way of ever – because everyone involved is so defensive of this work. So, like, police officers or prosecutors don't want to discredit Hain because then they will have to examine all of the thousands of cases that Hain has been involved in and say, like, oops, we fucked up, where they don't want to have to do that. So they just are just continuing to allow him to, you know, do his junk.
Right. Right. It's like no one wants to be responsible for – or no one wants to admit that they had any accountability for any of it, which is, like, you know, another great John Oliver segment is when he talks about attorneys generals. That's what they're called in plural, I believe. Attorneys generals.
Really?
Yeah, it's something weird like that. It's very confusing. I hate it because I feel like I'm saying it wrong, but it's not attorney generals. It's attorneys generals.
Wow.
Anyways.
You learned something new.
Yeah, he has a great segment on attorneys generals where he talks about, like, how – because, like, you know, it's an elected position and, like, you know, some judges are elected and all this, that a lot of the time the politics of getting elected get in the way of the actual doing the right or wrong, even though, like, I didn't know this. I can't remember what book it was that I read, but I did not know until relatively recently that the attorney general or, like, the defense – or the prosecution – they're actually required by their oath or by law or whatever standards they're allegedly held to, they are required to throw out cases if they find out that there's something, like, fishy going on. But they don't, because they're more concerned about getting convictions, because that's, like, one of the ways that they run in the future.
So messed up.
Same with judges. If a judge knows that something's not right, or, like, someone lied, or something does not match, or the science isn't right, they're also supposed to declare a mistrial. And they often don't, especially in places like Mississippi, where they're running, not to disparage Mississippi, but, like, where they're running in a state that's tough on crime.
Right.
And, like, we're being liberal on the death penalty is looked at as a negative because they know that that will get held against them. And we hear that a ton in the book about, like, how person voted to acquit a child murderer. How dare he?
Right. But it's like, that's not what happened. This wasn't the person that killed the child.
Right.
And not only that, but you have – not only do you have an innocent man on death row, but you have a man who murdered a child running around
free. Well, who murdered two children and he could have been caught the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, like, whew. Not even to talk about the crimes that were so disgusting and just wild and horrible, but child murder and sexual assault of 3-year-old girls.
Ugh.
gross.
Really awful.
Really
and,
awful.
Yeah, and the second one could have been prevented had they caught him the first time, but instead right. they put an innocent man in jail because they just wanted to get that conviction.
Right. Who also had an alibi. I'm so confused. He was literally at his job with people.
It reminded me of-
I need to know what the transcript of, I want to see that courtroom scene between the defense attorney when he, like, did he not call?
Well, he did, but I think it's like, that's like the racism, right? Because you right. probably had a predominantly white jury
right.
who is like, right. okay, well, these black people are just not trustworthy, which is so so problematic. And it right. reminded me of Just Mercy a lot. And that guy who wasn't, he had a fish fry.
Right.
And,
right. But this guy, didn't he clock
in? He was
in?
At work. Yeah.
Wasn't there like, I understand. I can understand in Just Mercy, he's at a fish fry for his whole family with his whole family. And his alibi is his family.
Yeah.
Like, at least I'm like, okay, but this dude was at work. Like yeah. people were patrons that day. Like people who probably don't even like him were patrons that day.
Yeah.
It's just like, what, I mean, I act like I'm really surprised. Like, I can't believe this would happen. But also the other part of me is like, of course it happened. Mm-hmm. It's more like feigned surprise and strong anger.
It's just frustration yeah. because it does feel very hopeless.
Yeah. It just feels like, what do you do? How do we do better? And, you know, part of it is like, they talk about how, so medical examiners are doctors, which means they had to go through med school and a residency, and they had to like become a doctor to do the work. And a lot of doctors don't want to be pathologists. They don't want to deal with dead bodies. They mm-hmm. want to help people. They mm-hmm. got into the field to heal illness or cure cancer or deliver babies or treat diabetes or whatever it is. And like, I think that it's not super attractive to be like, I'm going to be in a room with dead bodies right. all day and deal with murder.
And it doesn't pay as well as like yeah. the other ones.
And like deal with not just dead bodies, but also the police
right.
and attorneys mm-hmm. and bureaucracy all day. Ugh, I wouldn't want to do it.
Me either.
Yeah, but like, how do you get people to want to do it? Like, what does the government need to do to incentivize people to go into pathology?
Well, I mean, Stephen Hayne was able to make like over $1 million a year. And so right. it's like, how do we get people involved without all of those kickbacks? Because what happened was right. he got involved with the, like, once, if they get involved with the mortuary side of things, then they can make a lot of money.
Right.
But,
well, and Stephen Hayne was doing like corrupt. A billion.
Yeah. So,
kajillion.
For people who haven't read the book, the standard body of forensic medical examiners, I don't know, whatever the term, they recommend like two to three hundred a year, autopsies. This man was doing over 1,000 and proud of it.
1,500
And
year.
That's impossible.
They did the math. I don't know if you remember the part where they did
like
the math.
It was like 2 to 3 hours.
It was like 3 hours an autopsy, which is the minimum that's recommended. But with the math, they said that he would have had, that includes
no
0 days for hobbies, for naps, for vacation,
food,
for days
eating.
Off, for eating, for anything else. So like, there's no way he was spending the recommended 3 hours, even if he worked every single day. Like, is he eating over?
Right. I just really don't understand. Well, oh, and then they have parts where he's like, he was like testifying or including in a report about this person's uterus, and it was like a biological male. Like a
right.
cisgender man.
Right. Like there were mistakes that were made or like about like someone's like appendix, but then
who had been,
taken out.
Yeah.
And like things that he missed or like wrote or things that not even things that he missed, things that he wrote in his notes, like healthy appendix. And it was like this person's appendix was taken out 25 years mm-hmm, ago. Mm-hmm. So like that he was falsifying his reports, not just because they make the point, like, there is a world in which you don't comment on the lack of an appendix because you don't really notice it. But there isn't a world in which you see a healthy appendix when there is
right.
none.
And then again, like, just the lack of accountability where everyone else involved in the system didn't want to question him because he made their jobs easier and their lives easier and he
right.
put people away. And so they, like, loved him. But then they failed to catch all of these red flags and still have had no accountability for their lack of
right.
I don't know,
so oversight. What's the solution? Does there need to be some sort of like systemification? What, that's not the word. What's the word? Standardization
yeah.
of what science is allowed or
well, so that's the thing too, is he he lied about his certification. So he wasn't, he's had to be board certified by this specific board, but he would say, I'm forensic science or whatever. Like he did the like junk one.
Yeah, like the pay, and so he pay, was pay
able
to play.
Yeah, exactly. So he was able to just lie about that. So, I mean, I don't know, like actual listening to the certifications, not just like allowing him to smudge the
right.
whatever. And
but like I guess what I'm asking is like how can you expect any defense attorney whose job it is yeah. to defend people, and most likely a lot of the defense attorneys who are tasked with this are the ones who are defending people who can't afford yeah. a private attorney, who have a bunch of clients who are like exhausted themselves and don't have the resources to do all the work. Like there's got to be some sort of governing body or something that says, or like a list.
You know what? The solution is prison abolition. I don't think sure. there's any other solution, because we have to stop viewing people as like, as expendable, and stop, right. you know, once you commit a crime, then you are completely out. There's, I don't think there's any way to reform the system. I think, I can't think of one other than right. to just scrap it and move to a transformative justice model.
I want you to talk about prison abolition, because it's kind of like a hot topic. Yeah. And I feel like people hear that and think like you're advocating that like no people who ever do anything wrong right. should have any punishment.
I don't know like the nuts and bolts of how it works. I okay. will say the book that turned me into a prison abolitionist was Invisible No More by Andrea J. Ritchie. Mm-hmm. Because I read that book and I was like, there's no way to reform the system.
Right.
Like there's no way to fix this organization that is corrupt and racist on right. every single level. I don't know. I'm going to get someone who's like, I'm a cop and I'm a good person listening to this. That's not what I'm saying. Sure. Like I'm saying it's systematic, right? Because there's the system and then there's the individual.
Right.
Individuals can be good, but systems are broken. Prison abolition, I mean, I think transformative justice is like centering the survivor. So centering the person who was targeted by the harm and saying like, what do you want?
Right. But then you have people who can
would
be,
want
who
prison.
Can be like overly lenient or overly vindictive, yeah. right?
Well, I wish I had the book that I'm reading now, Pleasure Activism. She just defined transformative justice and I underlined it. I was like, I need to remember this and I forgot it. But it's, yeah, I don't know. I don't know, because I think that the thing is like we have criminals running around now, right?
Sure.
Because in this book, like what Johnson, he right. was free for however many years.
Right.
And I think like also if you look at prisons, people who are sent away for nonviolent offenses into these high max security prisons and then are around like terrible criminal, you know, like, I don't know, again,
violent offenders.
Yeah, violent
like
offenders or people
right.
who actually have like killed other human beings, and you put in like a low level, like someone who sold like $30 worth of weed in with someone who has murdered six people, that person, you know, that's like how we have a recidivism problem. I
right.
mean, among lack of like finances. I don't know. I'm not the expert, so I hope no one
right.
quotes me on this, and also debate me if I'm saying something wrong. But I don't, yeah, I don't know the solution. That's not my area of policy.
Right.
But I know, I mean, I'm not a policy person. I don't know how it would work, but I just, it's not working now.
Right. It doesn't work now. I mean, I am all for major overhaul
yeah.
of prison. I don't know if I'm a prison abolitionist because I don't think that I know enough
yeah.
for sure. But I do feel like within the confines, some of the confines, I guess, of what prison is now, I think that like we have to have a much more diligent system of sending people to prison.
Okay, so this is the thing that she said in Pleasure Activism. I just remembered. She says addressing the system that created the individual too.
Sure.
So like if you have someone who has mental health problems, and so they are like the person in this book, Johnson, he has a mental health challenge. And again, not everyone who has mental illnesses is violent.
Right.
Let me just, if
reiterate
this is
that.
What you're
yeah.
saying, if this is what you hear me saying, that's not what I'm saying. Just because you have mental health illness does not mean you are going to be violent. If there is someone who the reason why they are violent is because they have untreated mental illness, like then the solution would be to treat their mental
right.
illness. Or if they have someone who is, I mean, stealing a loaf of bread, right? Because
right.
they're poor. Then the solution is to help them get the resources to live a life in which they can provide for themselves.
Right.
So it's like addressing the system and not just punishing the individual for the system that created
right.
those conditions.
Because I think like overall, this
or
might
addiction.
Be, yeah. This might be like an overly general statement, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. Most people don't want to commit crimes.
Yeah.
Like I think most people, I would venture to say 99.9% of people don't want to commit mm-hmm. crime. They feel like they have to for whatever reason, mm-hmm. or their chemicals and their brains or the imbalance yeah. or whatever, you know, cause like Johnson, this guy, he commits these two crimes and he has an attempted rape earlier before. But once he, like, once I feel like they get to him and he's put away and whatever, he feels badly. Like, he expresses remorse mm-hmm. and regret, and he has shame around it, which shows that, you know, I mean, as much as we can believe whatever we're being told in this book, which I have to assume that we can because we're talking about it, so I'm going to trust the authors, it feels as if, like, when treated or institutionalized or whatever, I'm not exactly sure his full journey, right. but there is a sense that he didn't want to do that, and that it was because of his mental mm-hmm. illnesses mm-hmm. that hadn't been treated mm-hmm. that allowed for him to justify it. And like, even during, like, because what happens is the authors tell us what happened
right
from Johnson. And so there are times where he like kind of like tries to get out of it and then like feels compelled by the voices right, to yeah. continue. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, again, as much as you can believe someone who's retelling this heinous crime that they committed, you know, I feel like there's probably some yeah. revisionist history in there on his part, which I understand because like it's pretty gross stuff. But again, like as this all ties into prison and the accountability of the justice system is like, we have to be more diligent with what we use to send people to prison. Cause it's not just like a timeout. I feel right. like people think jail and prison is like a timeout. Mm-hmm. Like if you do something bad, you go to jail for a year. Like, first of all, a year is a really long time. A year in prison, that is not a joke. A week in prison sounds like my worst nightmare.
Especially because the conditions in prisons are totally inhumane because right. we view people as having caused crimes as deserving that kind of treatment.
Right, right. Like other places in the world, the prisons look like college dorms.
Yeah. I'm totally never going to be able to be elected office because I'm saying all this stuff. Not that I'm running, but I'm soft on crime, I guess, is what I'm learning.
You're proudly soft on crime. Well, but no, it's not soft on crime. It's just like crime. It's like prison as a last resort, not prison as like a holding place for people to go because right. we don't have any, because we don't want to put the money other places.
Right. And I think, so here's the thing. So I have lived a great life. Okay. I think the thing that he talks about with Sonia Smith, the one of the daughter's mothers, and how her rights as a victim are completely ignored by the justice system. And also Brian Stevenson talks about this in Just Mercy, like the victims' families, like those are people who are literally victims of a crime mm-hmm. who have been mistreated by the system. So it's not just me saying like we need to be nicer to criminals. It's like this system is just it's not actual justice.
Right. I'm of two minds about this though, about the families of like murder victims, because I think a lot of the time, I don't know how much of the time. I think some of the time they are very compassionate and they feel like, you know, they don't want to see mm-hmm. someone locked away or they're not sure or whatever. But I think on the flip side, there are also people who are extremely vindictive and hold on to yeah. non-science and just a feeling or an instinct.
Because
they want closure yeah. or justice. And so I feel like while I understand like you want to take that into account somewhat, I also feel like it's really dangerous and a slippery slope because mm-hmm. that also has a lot to do with That's race and true. Racism. Mm. Like we so often ask Black people and Brown people to be forgiving and understanding and to give people a second chance. But like no one's giving these Black men a second yeah. chance. Mm-hmm. Y'all didn't even give him a first chance.
Yeah.
Like they were at work. One of them was. But so I think that like, one of the prime examples of this to me is, are you familiar with the Brock Turner case?
Oh,
he was the Stanford kid who yeah. sexually assaulted mm-hmm. A woman. He was a swimmer. And what happened was the probation officer recommended a light sentence on him. And then the woman wrote a letter. And I guess when the woman had first spoken to the probation officer, she had said like, go easy on him, allegedly. And then she wrote the letter that was like, that went viral and became this whole big thing, which kind of like brought the story to the foreground even more. And the judge basically was like, this kid has a bright future in front of him. We're not going to put him in jail at all. And that is like a prime example of using right. a victim to kind of like have a scapegoat, like yeah. to say, oh, the victim wanted this thing. And it's like, she shouldn't, not only should she not have to, we shouldn't be relying on victims for punishment. If we believe that this is the correct punishment, we should have accountability within our system, yeah. right? Do you know what I mean?
No, I think that's so true. And I think like survivor-centered justice is a really interesting idea that, again, I just like don't know what it's about, because it's so different than the system we have now. Because I think like I do not feel at all sorry for Brock Turner. I right. think that he deserves like accountability for his actions. He also is operating inside a system of patriarchy and white supremacy.
Right.
That's not to excuse his actions.
No.
But it is like we need to tackle both the system and hold the individual accountable. Well, right.
I mean, that's the other part of it is like, do we believe that Brock Turner should be the person who gets yeah, the lenient sentence because that's right. what we hope for in the future? Or do we believe that Brock Turner should be held to the same standards as Levon Brooks would have been or as so Kennedy Brewer?
But it's also, you can't compare the two because right. Brock Turner is a white man and they are black men and we know how society views
right. But I guess the question yeah. is like, ideally,
yeah.
Ideally, do we say, okay, oh God, we believe know. In less harsh sentencing. We believe in second chances. We believe in the future of young men and women who commit crimes. And so therefore the Brock Turner sentence is correct. Mm. Or do we say we believe in, you know, vindicating these crimes. We believe in teaching sexual predators a lesson. We believe in our justice system as it is and that we should be convicting people and giving them harsh punishments to encourage them not to commit crimes again. You know, because like Brock Turner, a lot of me is like, great, people shouldn't go to jail for a long time. But the other part of me is like, why, like this white boy shouldn't get off if
right.
all these young black men and brown men and women
or like selling weed.
Who's, yeah,
yeah.
Or trans people or people who yeah. are, you know, who are sex workers. Like these people shouldn't be any more criminalized than this kid for his crime that is violent, first of all, you know, like, so there isn't a right answer. I just think that like when we start to center the voices of victims and victims' families, I feel like we haven't figured out as a society
yeah,
what
exactly.
we want to be doing to be able to balance that input fairly.
Cause I think it's just like, it's, we can't conflate the two because they're so different.
Right, of course.
And so it's just so, yeah, I don't know. Because I'm thinking about, like, all of the white kids who, like, commit, I don't know, I just read this article about these kids who did a quote-unquote senior prank that was basically a hate crime, like all this, like, racist graffiti against their black principal in, like, Maryland. Washington Posted this article.
I feel like this happens every year.
And it's
year.
Like, yeah, right? And it's like, well, do we let them off? And it's, no, you know, so I don't know. So now I've been talking about prison abolition and I'm like, well, those kids and Brock Turner need to be held accountable
right.
for these horrible actions, but they're not because our society values their future.
Right.
And I don't know.
And all of this is just like prison sentencing. And this isn't even like scraping the surface of yeah. the death penalty, right. which is also comes up in this book because Kennedy Brewer is sentenced yeah. to death. So he spends like 5 or 6 years on death row
right.
But he's in jail for like 13 years or something.
And I don't know. How do you feel about the death penalty?
I'm firmly anti-death penalty.
Same. It's just not
yeah.
done right.
Well, I also don't believe that the government as an entity is supposed to be better than the people.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand if you, Allison, something terrible happens, God forbid, to one of your family members, you personally feel like I want that person to die,
mm-hmm.
but you are not the government and the governing body of millions and yeah. millions of people.
Mm-hmm.
And
true.
You don't speak for our identity.
Yeah.
And so to me, I mean, it's the same thing with like putting children in cages. Like that is not something the government should be doing because that is something that you're saying that I then believe in as a citizen
oh
of
God,
this country.
That's so sickening.
You know? So like I'm firmly anti-death penalty because I believe an eye for an eye is something you can enact on a personal level, but I don't believe that's something that the government should be enacting for on anyone's behalf.
Mm-hmm.
I read a book called The Autobiography of an Execution.
Hmm.
David R. Dow, maybe it's kind of older. And I think in the beginning of the book, I think this is where I got it from. He talks about how in certain cultures, what the government will do if someone's convicted of a crime, or maybe this is what they used to in the old days, I can't exactly remember, is they would give a family member a knife.
Oh, wow.
And say, if you want to physically kill this person, you can. But we aren't going to do it for you. Mm. And you have to look them in the eye and you have to do it.
Oh, God.
Which all of a sudden makes it a really different thing. It's a whole other thing when, you know, a cop and a doctor go into a room and the person's blindfolded and they've been kept away from their family. And it's like medical and they don't feel a thing, which is bullshit because they do, which isn't even my problem with it. I actually don't have a problem with, I mean, there are problems with the way that death penalty is done, but my problem is just fundamentally, I think that it's wrong for the government to sentence any of its people to die.
And we can't, I mean, I think for me, it's like, I like that a lot because my thing is just that it's totally,
valuable.
Yes. Yeah. And it's oh my goodness. It's not consistently applied.
Right.
It's totally inconsistent. It's,
right.
It's littered with racism.
Right.
And classism and racism, right. You know, so it's right. Like, how can we trust it? We can't.
Right.
And so it's just the government, you know, because cops who kill black men or black people, cops who kill people of color, cops who kill people right. aren't getting the death penalty.
Right.
It's innocent people like Kennedy Brewer.
Right. Exactly. Well, that's the thing. It's like, I also disagree with the death penalty on a lot of like smaller issues, like the fact that the likelihood to be put on death row has more to do with the color of the victim than it does the color of the perpetrator. Mm. So white victims, murders of white victims are more likely to get prosecuted and sentenced to death penalty than murders of black and brown people. But all of that to me is almost secondary to the idea of what does it mean to commit. Yeah. You know, like there's so much shit that's fucked up with how the death penalty is now currently. But all of that comes down to me to the idea of like, why are we putting people to death?
Mm-hmm,
Did I force you to read The Reckonings?
No, but I'm going to.
Okay. So Lacey Johnson, who you all know is the love of my life, she's very into death penalty activism. And she actually wrote an article this year, recently, I want to say since March, about God, I can't remember the guy's name. I don't remember if you remember in Texas, I think his name was James Byrd. He was a black man who was picked up by three white dudes. They put him in a truck. Then they dragged him behind the truck. It was like 1999. Okay. It was this horrible thing. It was a terrible hate crime. One of those men was put to death recently. And Lacey Johnson writes this amazing, amazing piece about, I'll link to it, about how even though he admits to it and says he would do it again, she's still fundamental. Like, she basically is making the point that, this is like dregs of humanity. This is the most racist, horrible, toxically masculine man. And even still, he does not deserve to be put to death. And like how Bird's son also did not want him to be put to death, even though they knew for sure he did it. Mm-hmm. And like he fully admitted, and the other two men and this whole thing. But she talks a lot about like what the death penalty is. Mm. And it's in her book also. There's a chapter called, or an essay called On Mercy, that's about children with terminal cancer. And she kind of like juxtaposes these children with people on death row. And I just think it's like a really interesting conversation to be having, like when we talk about less about specifics of systems, but more about who we want to be as Americans, or like who we want this country to be. And I think like fundamentally the death penalty is one of the things like about America that I don't think we've really thought about.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. Not to get too philosophical, but
from the book.
It's away
it's
from the book.
It's relevant to the book.
But, you know, read The Reckonings, read the autobiography of an execution.
Well, the book I need you to read is the Alex Marzano Lesnovich book,
Fact of a Body. Lacey recommended that book to me also.
Yeah, they talk about how they were staunchly anti-death penalty and then basically had their experiences as a survivor of childhood sexual abuse sort of triggered in them. And while they were defending death row inmates who had committed sex abuse, child sex abuse, and it is it's a phenomenal book. And now I can't remember the conclusion because – I mean, it's just an
where you mean where they ended up.
Yeah,
on the
yeah. I mean, I think that it was still I don't know. But
well,
read the book.
Read the book and then you'll find out. I have it. I bought it because of
so
you.
Good. Oh, yay.
Before we wrap up, I do want to talk about the title and the cover. The cover of the hardback and the paperback are pretty much identical, which I always kind of like. I feel like I'm not missing out on anything. Yeah. What do you think? Title. The title is The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist, A True Story of Injustice in the American South.
I thought it was really stupid.
You don't like the title? Talk about it.
I just was like, what on earth is this book that Tracy wants me to read? Like, it's so hokey. Like, it's totally... Well, and it's funny because in the... I did like the book, so I hope I'm not shitting on it.
No, no.
And, lack of anti-racism criticism, relevant. And that aside, I think I did like the book. That said, like, the title, I was like, this is... In his short stacks, he was like, people thought it was going to read like a John Grisham novel, and then it didn't. And I was like, well, that's why. Because the title is very like,
interesting.
I guess I've never read a John Grisham novel, but I feel like it's very like sort of like true crime or like murder mystery title-y. Mm. And the book deals with a lot more history of coroners and forensics than I was expecting. Like it has more context. It's not just about the crime. And from, first of all, the blurb on the paperback is really bad.
Is it?
The blurb on Goodreads is better. No, the blurb on the paperback is like totally, I don't know. I thought it was insufficient. I would never have picked it up. But the blurb on Goodreads was better in describing and making it seem interesting. Hmm. And then I started it and I was like, but it did definitely get picked up.
I like The Cadaver King. I don't know if I needed And the Country Dentist. I know that Michael West is like a big part of the book, but I wonder if there was a way to write like something called like Cadaver Kings. Or something like talking about people who deal in the death industry and like finding a different subtitle. It's just a really long title, which rarely works to me.
Same. And it feels a little, it just feels a little hokey.
Yeah. Like, but I didn't dislike it. Like, I actually think that it works and I think it kind of like piques interest. And I think the problem with it is that it's long and you can't always remember it.
Yeah.
The way that I actually first heard of this book is Nancy Rommelman, who wrote To the Bridge when she was on like last year. She said it was one of the last like really great books she'd read. And I remember hearing it. And then I was at Skylight Books, which is a bookstore here in LA, at Aro Kwan's book event. And where I was sitting, the book just happened to be facing out on the bottom shelf. And I was like, oh my God, that's that Nancy book. And so then I saw the cover and that's what made the book stick with me. That's cover, funny. I think, is really powerful.
Yeah.
And I think it's like very cool and artsy in a way that often I feel like true nonfiction-y books aren't.
Yeah. I don't know. It just didn't seem like something I would pick up.
Yeah, I agree.
But that's not to say, but I actually did like it.
Yeah, I don't think the title is fully connected to the contents of the book.
Yeah.
But I do like Cadaver King. I think that's like kind of like
catchy.
Yeah.
Well, that's what everyone calls it.
Right. Cadaver
King. Like, I would never say it. Because I also couldn't remember if it was the country dentist
or county.
The county.
Me too.
Then when you were on your interview with him and you said country, I was like, oh my God, she got it wrong. But no, it's country.
No, it is country. Yeah. I didn't get it wrong.
No, I'm sorry.
Don't at me. It's country. I'm looking at it now.
Right,
no.
Right.
But do you like the cover? Are you into the cover?
Well, so there's a hearse on the cover, right? And like, does Hayne drive a hearse? I wouldn't think
he did. No, but the guy he was friends with
Jimmy.
Yeah,
Roberts.
Roberts. He would have.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I thought it was fine. I don't know. I'm glad that you helped me pick this book because I don't know that I would have read it anyways, but I learned a lot.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing, because there are so many books in the world, I just wouldn't have prioritized reading it, but I learned a lot from reading it. So that's why I like to do book clubs and stuff, because they get me to read.
That's how I feel too. Yeah. That's kind of how I feel like about how we pick books in general on this show is I'm like, we should try something we've never done before. Even if you don't like, I mean, I liked it and you liked it, but even if you don't like it or even if you have a lot
of
criticism, there's a lot to discuss and there's a lot to engage with. I personally actually love the cover. I think it's like very catchy and sticky. I know it's not
very foreboding.
Yeah. Like I love how there's just like this tiny, tiny portion of the cover that even really matters. Like the top is basically black and the bottom is basically like green. But yeah, I just really, I think it's aesthetically pleasing. And as someone who you can relate, we read a lot of nonfiction. And I think a lot of times nonfiction covers lack creativity or like imagination or like often even just like a visceral feeling. Like, for example, I love How to Be Anti-Racist, but I think that cover is not It doesn't connect to the content of the book at all. And it doesn't connect to human, like, I'm not like, oh, I'm dying to pick that up. Not that you should judge a book by its cover, but like this cover has intrigue to me.
But I feel like because that title is so strong.
Yeah, sure.
That's fine. And that title
cover. But like Stamped from the Beginning cover is also not great.
Yeah.
Like I feel like sometimes I think, I don't know. I can think of so many. Just Mercy cover is not great. Blood in the Water cover is great.
Really good. Really good.
Tinderbox cover is great.
Yes, that's true too.
But I just think that like oftentimes nonfiction covers don't get, they don't get the like artsy treatment that they should get. And I think that's sometimes why people don't think that they want to read nonfiction.
Yeah.
Like even subconsciously, even though I'm not accusing you guys of not judging a book by a cover, but I do think we all do it. Mm-hmm. And I wish that publishers who publish these amazing books with all this research and hard work took it more seriously.
More beautiful nonfiction covers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because even if it's not exactly the book.
That's like beautiful nonfiction covers.
Don't steal it, people. We're doing it. Starts today. Well, we might already start it before. But yeah, it's true. Beautiful nonfiction covers. More of them.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to throw out about this book before we're done, before we wrap it up?
I don't think so. I liked it. I'm glad that I read it. I think there was a, like, yeah.
Do you think, I'm not going to ask you, I'm going to tell you. I think for me, this is one of those books that's going to stick with me a lot longer than I thought that it would.
I totally agree.
Because I think that the information in it is going to come up over and over and over again. And like knowing more about junk science is going to be really sticky and like topical for the rest of our lives.
I think that's so true because it's, again, I knew CSI. I love CSI. I knew it was not like,
right.
I knew it was not as portrayed, but I didn't know how badly
how
it was
not as portrayed,
which is like pattern matching is not like scientifically sound. Stuff like that, that it's like, now that I know that, it makes perfect sense, but I really did not know.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so I think this book has longer returns than even I can imagine at this moment.
Yeah, I just, again, that's what I would say is like, if this is the first book you've read on like race in the criminal justice system, it did not sufficiently into it.
Right.
So make sure you read other books.
Right. Well, this book definitely is not race in the criminal justice system. This book is like very niche criminal justice for sure.
Which is helpful to know.
Yeah, I think so. I definitely think so. Okay, we're going to wrap it up. Allison, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tracy.
Yay. And
hi, Becky.
Oh, hi, Becky. The Cadaver King and the Country Dentist by Radley Balco and Tucker Carrington. It's out in the world. You can get it in paperback and hardback wherever you get your books. We're linking to that. Everything else we talked about in the show notes. And of course, Allison's social media handles as well. Allison, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And we will see you guys in the stacks. Okay, we're done here. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Allison Punch for being our guest. Everything we talked about on today's episode can be found in the show notes. For more from The Stacks, follow us on social media at The Stacks Pod on Instagram and at The Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. To join The Stacks Pack and get inside access to this show, go to patreon.com/thestacks. Thanks to Audible, listeners of this podcast get a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Make sure you're subscribed to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening to us through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review. Our graphic designer is Robin McCright, and our theme music is from Tegirajis. This show was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.